get real, man. You know, real guys talk real sports. We will. Race, market, game, change. Start to get real. These are the kind of guys I need to have in the locker room. The championship type guys. Certain guys, you just got to recognize, I got to pay the money, I got to keep it. Everybody has an opinion.
They came with so much bravado and so much swagger.
We're not going to make it. Sometimes you got to clear space where there's no space.
I can't argue with LeBron with this.
I do have a good problem with education. Right? He burned a lot of bridges.
He's going to be hated in Chicago. He's going to be hated in Cleveland. He's going to be hated in New York. And that's what I'm excited to see.
I blame it on Nintendo. I blame it on the fact that they never played against a team that's going to be as dominant as this team could be.
The true villain team. The team that everybody wants to smack in the mouth every time they play them.
That's right. Welcome to the Real Sports Guys. We're real guys, talk real sports. It's Renegade Radio. This is your guy, D. Wilson, on the line, taking over for the game changer who is on IR for the night. But that's all right. We got Phil T. Phil T is like the super sub. He's like that cat that comes off the bench, wins six-man award. He might be Jet. He might be the Jet type guy. You know, down in the fourth quarter, he's going to try and take those big shots. Phil T, say what's up to the people.
What's up, man? I'm more like Vinny Johnson, the microwave in the 80s and 90s. Okay? I'm a bit more consistent. I'm a bit more consistent than JT been showing us here. You know, than Jeff been showing us. I'm a bit more consistent, but I'm here with you, man. Ready to have a good night. Good show. We got a lot of good stuff on tap, man. Ready to ride with you.
Yeah, this is gonna be a good night tonight. We sitting here. We got the pivotal game four right now, the must win, and we'll definitely get to that. We got a lot on the docket in the world of sports. You know, we kind of go with the flow. But if you want to call in and join us and sit around the table, just call 347-989-0844. That's 347-989-0844. We welcome, you know, just as we always say, don't come weak. We will give you the Mutombo finger. We'll slap it off the glass. If you come to the basket a little weak, you got to come strong. But we invite everybody on. That's what makes the show work. Our Renegade folks who call in from all over the country make this show work. We do this for you. So we love to hear from you, and please join us on the show. You know, we like to, you know, often kind of kick off the show, you know, with what we call the funky editorial. And
fellas, one thing we need to say. Shall we say it, y'all? Melvin, Jimmy, Coleman, Ryan, say it. Everybody want to get funky one more time.
That's right, the funky editorial that is on here. And, you know, the way we're going to start this off right now is we're going to talk about the diesel. The funky editorial is about the diesel and its impact on the league. Try to, Phil, in the best way you can, try to maybe sum up how you feel Shaq has impacted the game. A lot of people are trying to come up with their, you know, top five or centers of all time and trying to figure out where Shaq fits. You know, but I would say that for both of us, Shaq is a guy that we watched, you know, for a long period of time, as we probably watching the game of basketball, and kind of talk a little bit about, you know, your impact. You think how Shaq impacts the game?
Well, first of all, I think Shaq is a first ballot Hall of Famer. You know, I was listening to some shows over the course of the weekend. And there seemed to be some minor debate around that. I think it's tough to rate players from different generations. You know, we've discussed that. And for me, I don't even feel versed enough to kind of rank people that I never saw play, such as Will or Bill Russell. From a non-basketball standpoint, you know, Shaq brought it, man. I mean, they showed a video of him with the Fushnikins back in the 90s, man. And I was just sitting there jamming, you know, because Shaq was trying to bring it like no other NBA brought it, NBA player brought it. You know, he kind of understood the business side of it. You know, he marketed himself really well. I think that's the biggest reason why he moved from Orlando to L.A., in addition to the possibility of winning. You know, from a player, Shaq was just absolutely dominant. He was absolutely dominant. You know, Mark Jackson was talking about him last week in terms of he was probably the biggest headache to game plan for since Jordan left. You know, I mean, outside of his free throw shooting, he really didn't have a whole lot of weaknesses in his game. His footwork and everything got much more solid as his career progressed. You know, if I look at ranking him in terms of centers in our generation, I would say the 80s on, I would put Shaq on the top of that list, neck and neck with Hakeem, which is kind of tough because the one center that truly dominated Shaq was Olajuwon. But Shaq was really young, and he was just kind of in the upstart of his career, and Hakeem was at the peak of his career. But when Shaq got to the peak of his career, there really weren't any big men that could really hold it down with him.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, one of the things that that I think I liked about Shaq is that he was very comfortable, and they talked a lot about this, you know, very comfortable in his own skin as a big man. He was the total package. So, you know, he won championships, but he also was able to dominate. He also was able to market. I mean, in terms of just his overall impact on the game, he made being big cool, and he played, you know, he dominated. I mean, there are things that, you know, we talked about. I mean, they talked about the fact that, you know, Shaq never led to him being rebounding. And, you know, a lot of people talked about, you know, ways in which he could have, you know, he missed, you know, 3,000, 4,000 free throws and in areas of his game he could have improved. But, you know, for a stretch there, he was the most dominant player in the game. You couldn't control him. It was something that he just, his power, speed, and athleticism made him, you know, if I were to pick, and, you know, I'm like you, I didn't see Russell or Will play or, you know, anything like that. I can't talk about it. You know, I think, to me, the best big man of all time that I saw play that combined at all would be Kareem. You know,
right.
I felt like Kareem was great on the offensive end. He blocked shots. He rebounded. They were talking about the first 8 years of his career. The numbers they were talking about were amazing stats. But, you know, even as he moved later in his career, he was just someone you had to contend with on both ends of the court. He controlled it. He had the best, I think, the balance of all of it. And he won at every level, won high school, college, and the pros, and was significant factors in all of those championships. So, for me, Kareem, and I know traditionally, you know, Wilt has got to be number one or number two just because on his numbers, if you didn't see him play, you know, to average as many points as he averaged, and even 1 year he led the league in assists or something like that, you know, just to show he could do it, that's a phenomenon. So I would go Kareem, I would go Wilt, and then I'm a little bit different than most people in that I might stick Olajuwon up in there in that 3-4 spot just because he combined power, athleticism, defense, the one thing about Russell is that Russell had a lot of Hall of Famers around him. He was a great player, great champion, won 11 championships, got to be in the conversation, got to be in the room. But, you know, he also played with, you know, a lot of Hall of Famers. and he averaged about 14 points for his career. He shot like 44%, 45% from the field. You know, I think when you talk about Will and Kareem, they were just dominant on both ends of the court, and they won championships. They didn't win 11, but they won enough. I mean, at a certain point, if you win like three or four, you know, particularly you're talking about Kareem, you're in the conversation. And then when you like a guy like Will, who can do it. But what Shaq brought was a little bit of all that. You know, the power, the will to win, the swagger with it, the cool to be big kind of thing. And that has to say something, too. So he was a champion. The way he did it was incredible. And, you know, he played with some great players, but he didn't always have the kind of talent around him all the time that some of these other players had. So, you know, I think Shaq's imprint on the game or impact on the game is going to be felt for a long period of time. And he's kind of a player you're not going to appreciate until he's gone. He's that kind of guy that you're not going to realize how good he was until you start watching highlights. You know, I don't think even the people who had a chance to see him play really appreciate how good he was as a player.
Yeah, I remember reading Phil Jackson's book, and at the time he had retired. It was after the 2003-04 season, in which he was coaching the Lakers, and they lost to the Pistons in the finals. And that was kind of right on the verge of the whole blow-up between Shaq and Kobe. And one thing that's always stayed with me in that book is, you know, Phil didn't speak too much about that rivalry between Shaq and Kobe. One of the things he did say was, you know, there were a few occasions where he had to pull them both in the office and say, listen, what's going on between you guys and the media? We need to stop this. What's the issue? Let's try to hash it out right now. And the thing that he said about Kobe was, Kobe would sit there and tell him, okay, I'm cool, and all of a sudden Phil would get home the next night and see Kobe, you know, on 2020 giving an interview, you know, where Shaq, you know, they would iron out their issues. He mentioned that sometimes Shaq was a little childish, a little bit, you know, had an ego, but at the end of the day, they would get things ironed up. Shaq would shake his hand, and that particular issue would no longer be an issue. And, you know, I thought about that when I was watching Shaq's retirement press conference earlier this week, you know, and it just kind of hit me, you know, Shaq did it a little bit different, which, you know, I mean, that's what he does. You know, he probably mentioned every other word how thankful and blessed he was for his parents.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of how respectful he was of the game and his family. And so from that standpoint, you know, I always felt, and again, we're outsiders, but I always felt that had Kobe met Shaq and, you know, the way that Shaq tried to meet Kobe, that perhaps they could have won another couple of championships. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm in no way suggesting that neither one of them were at fault. But again, just based on what some insiders have said, and then again from Phil Jackson's book, it just seems like, you know, Shaq had less of an ego, and he really wanted to try to make things work in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that, D?
Yeah, I mean, you can always tell by the people how people gravitate to Shaq. Like, across the NBA, outside the people outside, the hardcore people, I mean, Shaq is the kind of guy that just pulls people in. And so you can tell in the relationship, he's very comfortable with who he is. I think part of it, Kobe's issue was, I don't think Kobe was very comfortable. Kobe's just now becoming comfortable in his own skin towards the end of his career. Shaq was always comfortable in his own skin. And when you're comfortable like that, when you reach conflict, it's not important for you to win. It's important for you to get the right outcome. And I think Shaq was always okay with that. I think he was always okay with that with D-Wade. You know, he was very okay with the fact that trying to elevate D-Wade when they made that championship run. I mean, Shaq was, he demonstrated over and over again that it didn't always have to be about him. And so, you know, I think that if Kobe had become more comfortable with his own skin earlier, that they could have rolled that thing for another 2 or 3 years and done it right. Another thing I like about Shaq that people don't talk about much, but he mentions all the time, you know, he's working on his PhD.
Right.
And, you know, about to work on his dissertation. I mean, the value of education, the ownership Shaq has always taken to his brand and who he is, how he's empowered. I mean, I'd love to just sit down with him and talk about, you know, he's got a PhD in human resources. You know, I'd love to get some insight, because I always use, when I talk to athletes who commit, you know, to, you know, and their parents, I've always asked them how many of them know that Shaq has a master's degree and that he's working on a doctoral degree. And most of these college athletes don't even know that. And they're often surprised, and some of their parents are even surprised. And to talk about how he values education, and I think, you know, that's where I think he has so much similar to Bill Russell and Kareem, some of those guys from the 60s, of which education was a central part of who they are. Being greater and more aware and more worldly were important to them. And I don't think Shaq gets enough credit for wanting to do that. You know, and to me, that's, you know, people who know him talk about him being the most giving kind of person. But the way he values education, and I don't think his intellect is something that people often talk about, but he puts it on display all the time. And so that's part of him being very comfortable in doing some things that are not very conventional, where I think Kobe never could see himself doing that. Shaq had a very balanced life. So, you know, I think that's something that I don't think people have unpacked yet.
You know, oftentimes we think of great players and we often tie them to a sidekick or another great player they played with. You know, you think of Bill Russell, you think of Havlicek, you think of some of the other guys that he played with. You know, you think of Magic, you think of Worthy, you think of Kareem. You know, you think of, you know, Malone, you think of Stockton. I think in Shaq's situation, you know, I was thinking about this earlier, what one player do you think will be most connected with him? And I think it would be Kobe. But unfortunate for his legacy, I think a lot of people are going to remember how it ended in L.A. And not how good it was in terms of, you know, the anticipation when he left Miami, Orlando to go to L.A., and then all the wins and championships they strung together during his time there. But, you know, like, I think people are going to remember the divorce more. Whereas with Kobe, I think because Kobe won 2 additional championships after Shaq, and he was kind of the guy on those championships where, you know, Shaq, yes, he did win one with Dwayne Wade, and he was a dominant all-star type of center, but that certainly was not his team. And so, you know, I want to kick that question to you, but, you know, I think that Shaq is going to be related more with Kobe versus Kobe being related to Shaq, you know, when we look back in history 15, 20 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea that, you know, when you think about who he's going to be paired with, I think, you know, his time in L.A. is probably, and his relationship with Kobe is probably going to, and Kobe is probably going to be what people remember most. You know, in ways that's not uncommon, you know, in a way that, you know, Kareem was, you know, in Milwaukee, but, you know, you remember him a lot in terms of his Laker days. And I mean, there's, you know, different, you know, kinds of things like that. But I think he'll be, I mean, he'll be remembered his time in Orlando, but I think he'll be most linked with Kobe when you try to talk about who he was matched with and, you know, that's where they kind of just took on that mainstream and just started taking on that dominance. You know, but, you know, when the history books are written, you know, they'll definitely talk about the fact that it was contentious for both of them. You know, we're trying to coexist. So, you know, I think that's going to be just part of the legacy. But they did win, you know. And, you know, there's many duos that were there who played together who didn't necessarily all be, you know, didn't always get along. So, you know, I think that that's not uncommon for people who play together and win championships. It wasn't all, for a lot of people, it wasn't all gravy.
So, but, you know, one of the things, so kind of moving and transitioning, but staying with kind of the NBA kind of thing as we kind of move in a little bit, Mark Jackson, who I love in that three-man boot with Green, Jackson, and Van Gundy. I love that, you know, I love that dude, but now he's gonna be coaching the Golden State.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah, I was interested to see that hire. Mark Jackson got hired by the Golden State Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw it come across the ticker, it was either yesterday or this morning when I saw it. Yeah, you know, I was thinking good for him because, as far as I know, I don't believe he's ever been an assistant coach. Or a coach for that matter. You know, and I think about some guys who have went across that route.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you see ex-players that kind of go up the food chain and eventually get head coaching jobs, like, you know, a lot of the coaches we see. But, you know, I mean, Phil Jackson is a good example of that. But we also see, to a lesser degree, players who just jump in, you know, to a head coaching position, such as Doc Rivers. I believe he did that when he got his first coaching job with the Magic. He went straight from the booth, you know, to the sideline. And, you know, man, I go back to St. John's and Mark Jackson. You know, I remember being a kid trying to replicate his free throws. Remember he'd do the one or two dribble, he'd put up the fist to measure it, and then he'd shoot his free throw?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that was just always so old school and sweet to me, man. And, you know, I mean, since the release, I mean, you know, I think people forget sometimes this guy is a top 10 all-time in steals. I believe he's in the top 5 at this point in assists, you know,
mm-hmm.
probably around third or fourth. He had a heck of a career, man. You know, he played mm-hmm. quite a bit, you know, the better part of 20 years. So I think the Warriors' position is a tricky one. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there were a lot of qualified coaches that declined this job, such as a Van Gundy or some of the other guys that we've seen taking probably more higher-profile jobs because there's probably a question of, you know, what the heck are they trying to do out there in Golden State? I know they brought in Jerry West recently in the last year or two, but – you know, when I think of the Warriors, man, I think about teams that get up and down since the Don Nelson days. They've always kind of kept some kind of extension of that, but then they struggle on defense. They struggle in the playoffs when they get to the playoffs. You know, they shuttle superstars in and out. You know, back from Barron was there and Captain Jack. You know, and now I think they have a decent nucleus out there with Curry and what's the kid from Mississippi, Ellis. As well as the big guy from Florida that used to play in New York, Lee. But, you know, Mark Jackson said in his interview earlier he's going to try to make this a defensive squad.
Yeah.
I think he got his work cut out for him, man.
I think he's got some pieces to play around with, but you're right, you know, because I think, you know, that's the one thing about it is they talked a little bit about the I know I listened to his interview and a couple people. I mean,
he's been a point guard. You know, point guards have made decent coaches. It's not the first time somebody's come out of the booth to coach. He's got a good feel for the game. You know, a lot of coaching in the NBA is not just X and O's, but it's about putting the right coaches around you. I think he'll be a good X and O guy. But I also think, you know, putting the right people around him, but also is being able to connect with your superstars and getting them to buy in. And I think that's where I think he's really good is he's a good communicator. You know, he's a pastor and everything else, so the gift of communication is something that's in him, and I think that's critical. I think that's why Phil and certain coaches have done really well in the league. They've been able to communicate effectively to their stars, and then get the stars help you get everybody else to buy in. So I think some of his stars are young enough, and they remember him enough, you know, like Curry and some of these guys who will be very, you know, good because they're coachable. I mean, number of the guys he got. So they're going to make some moves. I think having Jerry West there is going to give him the kind of buffer that he needs. I think that's one of those things where, I think that, you know, having the right front office people, having the right, building the right, you know, kind of folks around him is going to help him be successful. You know, and frankly, you know, Vinny Del Negro got a coaching job and didn't have any coaching responsibility, didn't have any coaching background. You know, and he got two jobs. He went to Chicago, and then he got a job with the Clippers. And I'm not saying that those are bad hires, but again, it's not uncommon for people to have that opportunity. I just think there's some people you know that's going to be good naturals. I think the same thing I knew when Doc Rivers first got a coaching gig. You know, you just knew some of these cats are just naturals. You know, they're going to effectively communicate. They're good at organizing people. And I think that's what Mark Jackson is going to be good. He's going to be good at organizing, getting it right. He got Malone to come be his coach, assistant coach. So he's putting together the right people. I think he's going to be good because he's going to put together the right people to help him deliver the outcome that he wants. I'm happy for him. He's one of the guys I love. I love him when he's at St. Charles. I've always been a Mark Jackson fan. Just because he's just been that kind of guy. That what's great about him is that he competed at a high level, but he didn't have all the gifts and all the skill. It wasn't natural. You know what I'm saying? You know, he couldn't out-jump nobody. He wasn't fast to anybody, but he just found a way to play at an elite level. I always figured out, like, how is Mark Jackson killing him? He just was always killing him. And I was like, how are you doing?
Well, back to that half court if he had to. You know, his late days in Toronto and Indiana, I mean, he'd mess around and back you down, okay? He'd back you down and throw an alley-oop for the floater, you know? You know, I think he hit the nail on the head, though, man. He's about to bring in some strong coaches to be around him, you know. You know, I think of Larry Bird when he came in to coach Indiana. You know, Larry was the first one to say, listen, this coaching thing's new to me, so what do? I bring in some gurus.
That's right.
You know, I think he brought in Dick Carter, to be his defensive guy. He brought in somebody to be his offensive guy, you know. And you know, Mark seems like the type of guy where his ego will allow him to do that. And
that's
like
right.
You mentioned, he seems to be a very good manager. In terms of personality, you know, one of the things you see in the research in terms of feedback and feedback acceptance is a lot of that has to do with credibility.
That's right.
You know, so when you see guys, and they can go online and say, you know what, man, coach got more assists than Steve Nash. You know, he's got more assists than Isaiah Thomas, a lot of Hall of Famers.
That's right.
You know, I think that's going to help him connect with his guys better. I think that's going to help him connect with front office people as well while he's learning, while he's growing as a coach. And fortunately, he seems to be in a situation where the expectations won't be sky high.
Yeah.
You know, if Golden State won, again, I'm not for sure, but let's say they won 35 games last year. guess what? If they win 40 next year, that's going to be a heck of an improvement for that organization. And I'm sure they're probably looking at it as a 3-5 year process to get them to be a, you know, a competitor out west. Opposed to Mike Brown in L.A., you know, if the Lakers mess around and miss the playoffs or don't get a top four seed and, you know, get bounced out like they did this year, he's going to have a hard time out there. He's going to have a really hard time. So I think this situation Mark Jackson is stepping in, you know, like I mentioned earlier, I think a lot of veteran coaches may have stepped, you know, may not want this kind of job. But for a guy like Mark, it might be the right situation because even if it doesn't work, you know, you can put it more in the situation than the individual. He still may have additional opportunities after that.
Yeah, and I think because you got somebody like Jerry West involved, they're going to take the kind of patience they're supposed to take. I mean, you look at people look at the success of Memphis, but understand that Jerry West laid the foundation for that organization.
Yeah.
You know, he's been a winner wherever he's been. And so, you know, Mark is going to get the kind of support that he needs to do what he needs to do at the kind of time, you know, that realistic timeline that you're talking about. You know, Jerry's going to help set that so people understand they got to have, and the thing about it, the cover isn't there. So that's the thing about it. They can score points. So the key is, what do you do defensively? And some of that is getting some veterans to help you out, get some bigs who are vets. Sometimes it's getting the right savvy people who can help lock things down, bang a little bit. The West is going to be changing in terms of free agency. So there's some opportunities to move around and do some things. So, you know, part of it's going to be, you know, what you do in free agency to, you know, get some mid-level folks who can, you know, get some bangers, you know,
right.
And get some people who can help you defensively. Some of that's about how do you build your bench and get, you know, some folks who come off the bench who are savvy vets who can help you establish that. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to kind of get there. Some of that's going to be by scheme. If you look at, you know, something like Dallas, you know, they became a better defensive team, you know, in some ways just by the right, you know, playing enough zone in the right situations to be a scheme thing. So there's some of this stuff can be done by scheme, some of it's by rotation, adding a couple vets, you know, getting a guy that's a defensive-minded guy at the 3-4 spot that allows you to defend some of the best positions on the floor that you're going to see night in and night out. So I think Mark has been watching enough. There's a lot he's soaked in just by watching and connecting with people. And he's got a good sense of talent in the league because he's been watching them. So, I mean, in terms of talent evaluation and doing some of that stuff, I mean, he's been evaluating talent on a regular basis. So, you know, he might be able to find that diamond in the rough and be able to help with that. So, I'm happy for him. It's a long time coming. I know he's been interested in doing it for a long time. You know, there have been several coaching jobs over the years where I thought he would have been great for the Chicago job back in the day before this recent hire, you know, when they, you know, were looking out earlier. And so, you know, I'm glad to see that he has an opportunity.
Yeah, so I'm thumbs up on the Mark Jackson hire.
Okay. So let's hit this NBA game a little bit. Let's do a quick kind of cap on what you're thinking about the series, where it's at right now. What do you think about what happened in Game 3, now we're in Game 4, kind of moving through this. But just your reaction, I guess, recapping Game 3.
Well, first of all, you know, I got a two-mile horn for a second. Well, actually, it might be a little bit more than 1 second. You know, last week I had to go check out Albert Pujols, you know, playing against the Giants, so I missed the show. And I didn't get an opportunity to say I told you so about that Chicago Bull and Miami Heat series. You know, a few weeks ago I was on, and I got murdered. I got crucified, man. By you, Mark, Larry Randall, you know, because you guys got so excited after that game one victory with the Bulls, you know, when they beat the Heat with all those offensive boards. But I digress, man. I digress. I move on. No.
We gonna let you have it because you know, like I did during football season. I told people about Kansas City Chiefs. They thought I was crazy. You know, we all have our moments. So we gotta allow you opportunity to shine. That's why you on right now. That's why you with us through the summer, because you bring that perspective, and you're not afraid to step out. So I give that to you.
In all fairness, I did say the Clippers will make the playoffs as well. So, you know, you win some, you lose some. But in terms of this series, I think it's been really interesting so far. These teams are fairly closely matched. You know, right now Miami has a 2-1 lead over Dallas. And, you know, so far in this game four that's going on right now is pretty close here in the first half. You know, one of the things I predicted is that, you know, Dallas, they depend a lot on outside shooting. Less than they have in the past, but still some of their, you know, top players are primarily perimeter players. You know, you look at right now, J. Kidd really doesn't create a lot off the dribble at this point in his career. He's become a solid three-point shooter, but he's not going to be creating a lot of layups and easy shot opportunities like he did earlier in his career. Like, you think about last time he was in the finals with New Jersey. You know, so much of their offense came with him penetrating, fighting Kenyon Martin for 5-10-foot shots, if not dunks. You know, finding guys like Kerry Kittles for the intermediate jump shots and Richard Jefferson. You know, Kidd's just not that kind of guy. You look at Jason Terry, you know, the outside shooting always makes me nervous because when they hot, they hot. When they cold, they can get real cold. So I think, you know, honestly, I still think Miami wins this series, but I strongly feel like it's going to go 6 or 7 games because the Heat are still trying to figure out their identity, although I think they've come a long way. Just over this playoff run where, you know, they're comfortable down the stretch saying that it's not just Dwayne Wade's game to lose or it's not just LeBron's game to lose. I mean, they're okay kind of switching up the bounty each game, you know, based on the matchups, you know, in the situation of the game in terms of who's hot and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
So at the end of the day, man, I think it still comes down to these two teams are fairly evenly matched, but the Heat just have a lot more in the cupboard, man. Dwayne Wade, over the last couple of games, has showed everyone, you know, why he led and how he led Miami to the championship a few years ago. And LeBron, guess what? He's not Mike. He might be more like Magic Johnson. But guess what? He's getting criticized when he had 17-9.
Yeah, they people are crazy.
So that's my take on it. What's your take on it, man?
Well, first of all, I think you did a good job of kind of breaking that down. This is what I would. And this is going back to what you said about in the Chicago series. What turned Miami around is Haslam coming back. And the reason why I'm saying that is what I said is that Haslam has allowed for everybody, for the stars to align, allow for everybody to get back into their comfort position, allow for everybody, people like Joel Anthony, to just to be a shot blocker and a rebounder and not have to worry about scoring. Is allowed Juwan Howard to go to the bench, and if they need him, they can bring him out, but he doesn't have to be an important part of the rotation. It's allowed for them to get the natural rotation for everybody, and then on top of that, then that impacts D-Wade, and that impacts the way LeBron has to play. So then LeBron, instead of having to cover three, space to relocate and cover three or a man and a half, they're back to covering a man and a half. Now that's back to like Jordan and Pippen. You know, Jordan and Pippen can cover a man and a half. And when you allow them to cover a man and a half, that makes them potent. So they don't have to overextend themselves in a lot of different ways. So I think the Haslam coming back into the rotation said a lot. It helps them defensively, what you saw. I mean, they had Bosch on Dirk at the end of game two. He scored. You know, a lot of criticism around that. But then they were able to put Haslam on him at the end of game three. He still had a good look. But, again, it allows for people to be in their natural position. They might have had to put Bosch on him again if they didn't have Haslam. So I think right now they're just comfortable because they're all doing what they got to do. And then I think the final piece of that puzzle was Dwayne Wade finally saying, I'm the only one with the ring along with Haslam. I've been down this road. And the one thing I love LeBron's quote today where he said, if I wanted to play individual sport, I'd have picked up tennis or golf a long time ago. He finally had to let people know. And this is something I knew about LeBron, which I want to bet on when he came out of college, because I said he would end up scoring, you know, averaging 20 as a rookie, is when he was asked as a high school student about not scoring a lot of points and winning, and he said, the main thing is to win. I don't really care how we win. There's some nights where I'm going to have assists, and sometimes I'm going to have to rebound. And what they're forgetting is that he's been the best defensive player probably in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And no one saw that coming. It's not like he's never committed to playing defense. He's never done that. But the level of defense he's been able to play. The reason why they won in the series is because the Chicago series is that they were able to put LeBron on the right player that and not let him get off. In this series, it's been putting him on Jet.
Yeah.
Because if Jet has been the best fourth quarter scorer for Dallas, and he's basically neutralized them for, you know, even all three games, even though he got off a little bit in game two, and that was because LeBron wasn't on him, you know, he's neutralized the best player. And one of the things he said at the end of game two is, you know, look at game three. Look at what I'm doing on both ends of the court. This is where people in the press who have never even played the game sometimes are.
They sound like idiots.
Huh?
They sound like idiots, man.
They do, because it's like, do you understand the game? Like, do you watch the fact of how he's impacted the game? And what's happened is, this is the series where D. Wade is always going to have the best matchup. He's going to have J. Kidd on him. He's going to have Jet on him. He's going to always have the best matchup. So he should be scoring down the stretch. Whereas LeBron going to have Marion on him, probably one of the best defenders of three and fours in the league. I mean, Marion's a great defender. So he's going to have to work for his. Now, not like he's going to get it, but the game is about winning. It's about matchups. And if D-Wade has the best matchup, that's who needs to score. So I think what Dallas needs to do is one thing I look at is Dallas has got to get more. They got to board and get in transition. They need to get early offense. If you're going to get Jet off, one of the things they used to do is get early offense in the flow. And they're not getting enough early offense where even in transition, even if LeBron is on Jet, Jet can still get a good look because it's in break. And they don't do enough of that. Miami is forcing them into a half court offense, which is allowing Miami to set the defense. When they came back on Miami in game two, they were getting what they call the flow. They were getting in transition. They were getting that quick screen roll where they were doing the staggered screen, but it was all in transition. It was secondary break type stuff. It was forcing Miami to scramble, and they need to do more of that. And then Barrera and some of these other cats got to start coming through. And the killer is that it's been close in every game. So it's just it's not like Dallas isn't in it, but they gotta get into more. They got to speed up the game a little bit in a way that they haven't been speeding the game up. But it's an excellent series. I mean, it's going to be one of those things where, I mean, if Dallas wins tonight, you know, game five, another pivotal game, but they got to get some more scoring because you got to get away from two against one. And right now it's kind of like two against one, three against one. Dirk is getting no help. Somebody else has got to step up. And the only way they can do it is get into some kind of early transition.
One thing that's been very clear to me, man, is how good Dirk is.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, I think about when I was a kid. My dad, man, you know, he had guys, old school guys like Bob Pettit, you know, that he wanted to make sure me and my brother saw a play, you know, even if it was on 8-track, you know, real type of video. I remember as a kid, he made me watch the 83 championship series when Philadelphia won the championship, so I could see how good of a player Moses Malone was.
Yeah.
Moses Malone was a beast. He won some MVPs. He won this championship here for the 76ers, but his career, you know, it was really compacted in 3 or 4 or 5 years where he was dominant. Now, the rest of his career, he was an all-star type of player, but just his dominant years were kind of compacted together. And so, you know, I was thinking about Moses earlier, and I really see a lot of parallels between his career and Dirk's career. Now, in my opinion, Moses had a little bit more around him, especially when he was with Philadelphia with Dr. J and Tony and some other guys.
Mm-hmm.
But with Dirk, my fear is 10 years from now when he's retired, people are going to forget how good this cat was, man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's so dynamic. He can beat you in so many different ways. And every time I see him consistently hit this highly contested, fade away off the wrong foot, man. I mean, it just gets me out of my chair. Like, you know, I'm cheering for the Heat, but I can't help but admire how strong of a hooper this guy is.
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly, you know, doing what he needs to do to kind of get it going. I think we have we got a caller here. We're going to try and get on board here if I can. You know, we're going to try to get them on. Caller, you on? They kind of see if we get them on air here. You know, I'm trying to work them in. Caller, you on here? Okay. Caller, you on?
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. You there?
All right, can I get a minute with the real sports guys?
Oh, we got Mo up here. How you doing, man? Welcome
right.
back. What's up, man?
What's going on,
fellas? We're talking a little bit
about
the series. You're doing all right, man. We're talking about the series. Give us your feel, man.
Yeah, you know, I gave my halftime little call in here. I had a quick minute here. I heard you guys are talking about the game a little bit. So you got Big Phil down there, the big easy Scooby State down there, huh?
Yes, sir. Bringing it in from St. Louis.
All right, now. Sounds good. Now, I just want to get into the conversation a little bit about the finals here and see what's happening. And you know, I like some of you guys probably talking already a little bit, but you know, I think that you always comes back to me to the old adage that you know, defense wins championships, and you know, I kind of said earlier that whoever won that Bulls and Miami series was going to win. I think
we may have lost you a little bit. Okay, yeah, you're breaking up on
you. Got me.
Got you now. Okay, go back.
Okay. And I thought that, you know, Miami and Chicago have a really good shot because of the defense. And I thought that, you know, in the West Coast, that Dallas will not be used to seeing this kind of defense that's going to be put at them. And I think you've seen throughout the series, the scores have been really low. It's not really used to what Dallas been used to having in terms of being able to run down the court and score kind of at will and get a lot more open shots. And I think Phil kind of mentioned the fact that, you know, jump shooting team, and that Dallas has just been selling for a lot of jump shots. And when they're going good, that's but you know when they're not falling, or more importantly, when somebody's got a hand in your face most of the time, you know, you're definitely going to fall too much. And I think you know, Dallas has not really had a lot of ability to get to the line, get to the paint, to get some fouls, to get to the line and hit the free throws. You know, Dirk's been the only guy really kind of making a presence for them, and I think that's going to be their downfall in terms of the series. You know, I think they got a shot at it, but I think their margin is really thin. And you guys mentioned about Jason Kidd. You know, I think he's definitely you know, offensively, you know, limited. Defensively, he's not a good matchup for Dwayne Wade. You guys talked about how Dwayne Wade's been going off series, and I think that's, you know, part of the reasons that, you know, that he definitely has the big mismatch there in terms of who's guarding him. And so I think that, yeah, kind of similar to what happened in the last with the Bulls, you know, Dirk's kind of points, but beyond Dirk, no one else is really stepping up. And Berea, Terry, those guys, Page has been, he's been MIA, man.
Yeah.
So I was really surprised about that. But I'll give you guys a call for my feedback on the final so far.
Well, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mo. You know, I think defense is the key, man, because, I mean, if you look at it, Miami, they have the ability to match up. Like, they have favorable matchups with everybody who's guarded Dirk so far. Well, when I say favorable, meaning that Dirk's not going to go off for 40 or 50. Typically, you know, they can put Bosch on him. Joel Anthony's played him fairly strong. Haslam's played him fairly strong. And they can still throw LeBron at him at some point if they really need to later on in the series. Where when you look at the Heat, you know, you look at the big three for the Heat, Bosch, LeBron, and D-Wade. The Mavericks really don't have anybody who can really match up with those three, with the exception of Marion. I mean, they really don't have anybody. So, you know, I think we've seen that come at the end of these first three games where, you know, LeBron or even Dwayne Wade, they've just been beating whoever's trying to guard them off the dribble. And when they haven't settled for jump shots, which they did at the end of, you know, the last 6-7 minutes of game two when the Mavericks had that comeback, and they haven't settled for jump shots, man. Nobody can keep these guys from getting to the rack.
But I think we got to keep.
Lane, yeah.
But we got to keep in mind that in both game two and three, having said all that, Dallas had to look at it with a chance to win. Game two they won, and in game three, Dirk ball went off the back rim. So all said that they still had a chance to be up 2-1.
Oh, for sure, yeah. I definitely, you know, they definitely played well. I think that the biggest thing is, though, they've been, I think you see that Miami has almost still been in control all the games. And, you know, obviously they came back to the big deficit to win game two. But it seems like, you know, Miami kind of goes on runs, you know, easier, more easily. And, you know, Dallas, I think, has been down. I think, you know, I think I saw something like in they had a stat before the game is that Dallas only been in the lead, you know, only in that game when they won. At the end of the game, they had lead in the fourth quarter. So every fourth quarter, they've been down. And it just seems like they've been struggling a lot. It's been a lot more difficult for them to get their offense going to get points. And they're always playing from behind. They've been able to make some runs to get back into the game and get some shots going. But it just got the little things to me. It's like, you know, Dallas definitely, you know, they got to punch your shot because they got the offense and they got, you know, a superstar Dirk who could, you know, hit shots any time in the game. But it's like the little things that are going to add up. It just doesn't feel like Dallas really has a shot right now. I mean, they obviously can still win the game here. You know, I think they got definitely got to win these next two games in Dallas and have given themselves a real shot at it. But it just feels like Dallas is not really, you know, on the same level as they are so far. So we'll see what happens as things move forward here. But another thing I wanted to point out was that, you know, if there's, you know, I think, yeah, the last series, again, look at the Bulls, and what happened is that, you know, the offense for Miami now is becoming much more fluid, where they were doing a lot of one-on-one stuff. The ball's moving around a lot more, and you got the other guys who are, you got Bibby. That was kind of the key, like, you know, the same for both teams, I think. You get to have guys who are kind of the kind of marginal players scoring big points. So you got Bibby, you know, hitting, like, 4 3-pointers. You got Chalmers hitting 4 3-pointers in the game in separate games. You know, you got other guys like that who are scoring points that, you know, you just can't have. You know, it's going to be bad enough. You got, you know, Wade scoring 36, LeBron scoring 25, and Bosch scoring 18. But you can't have Bibby or Chalmers and those guys get double-digit scores and just kind of just bleeding you all over the place because there's too many things happening. And the thing with Dallas is that, you know, Barea's not scoring like he did in the last series. And, you know, Peja, that's just the MIA, you know, some of their role players. You know, lesser-known players. You know, Stevenson's hit a few three-pointers tonight, but, you know, those guys have not been doing much. So it's like, it's kind of a, on both sides of the ball, they're kind of getting, you know, they're players that need to score are not stepping up, and players that they can't let Miami score are scoring points too as well.
Yeah, I think the point guard position for Miami is a key for this series. You know, if Miami can get decent production out of Chalmers or Bibby, doesn't have to be both of them, I think Miami becomes really, in terms of these playoffs, an unbeatable team. Because Bibby and Chalmers are going to be the guys shooting most of those open three-point shots. You know, Mike Miller, you know, he's been a little bit inconsistent with his shooting, but for the most part, when Chalmers and Bibby, when they're shooting that ball well, man, in these last couple of series, specifically these last couple of games, Miami's tough to beat. I mean, they, you know, you almost have to throw your arms up. Like, what can you do to stop them?
Yeah, I think Chalmers, you know, or Bibby trying to be effective, because I think that's the one space where Dallas has got to win. They got to win with Kidd and Barea at that point position. They got to dominate that, and then they got to, and then Chandler's got to dominate down low with the rebounding and control in the middle. He's got to do that better than Joel Anthony. If you can control in those two spots, now that keeps you back in the game. And Chandler hasn't, in the games that they won, he's helped to control the boards and been an inside presence. In the games they struggled, he hasn't been effective on the glass. And they need some production from Barea. So I think those are the two places where they got to have production, where Miami doesn't quite have an answer if those guys play to their ability. So I think that's what you're looking for. But they, you know, Dallas's bench has been averaging, they said, 40 points a game. You know, and I know Jet is a big part of that, but a whole bunch of other people were scoring. And so they, some of these other guys have to come through, and they haven't been coming through.
What do you guys, how do you guys think the series would go, would be going right now if Caron Butler was available for the Mavericks?
It'd be a totally different game. We wouldn't be talking about who's stepping up. Again, Caron Butler is a lot, for this series, is a lot like Haslam. It allows people to play their natural position, their natural rotation. But when Caron's not there, now, especially when it comes up with a team like the Heat, guys got to play out of position, overextend more than they're comfortable doing. You know, that didn't matter as much with some of the other series they were in. But in this series, that does. I think Butler allows people to play their natural position, and he's the one guy who can get a shot on his own. So then he forces even Miami to match up differently. You can't really get away with guarding Jet if Butler's on the floor. You can't even commit LeBron to Jet if Butler's on the floor, right? Because if you put LeBron on Jet, then Butler's going to kill you. So I think not having him is means more for this series than any other series.
Yeah, I mean, Butler, I think of, you know, he's kind of on the level of Luol Deng, you know, maybe even an upgrade from Deng, where, you know, in respect of, you know what Deng's going to give you every night. You know, like Marcus always says, you know, Deng going to get you 17-7, regardless of your first option or third option. And Butler, when you look at his stats, I think he was giving them about 15 points, a couple of assists, 6 or 7 rebounds a game. You know, I mean, that's essentially what Deng giving the Bulls. And to have a guy like that to be your second or third scorer on a given night, you know, I think they've filled in for him very well throughout the rest of the season when he missed and obviously throughout the playoffs. But right now they're getting exposed because, you know, this is really the first series where the other team had somebody to guard Dirk. And again, when I say guard Dirk, I'm saying they're not giving up 40.
Yeah.
You know, they're not giving up 35 on a given night. You know, like they're keeping Dirk under 30, under 35. And so, you know, like you mentioned, D, not having Butler really exposes, you know, the Dallas and their consistent second or third scorers.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think, Big Mo?
Yeah, I think, it's obviously, they're talking about him being able to, you know, be close to being able to come back, and do they bring him back at this point after he's been missing so much time, and the chemistry of the team and those kind of things. So, you know, obviously a tough choice to bring somebody back if they haven't played in a long time to give them the kind of the legs and the energy they're going to need to kind of play in this kind of environment. But, you know, I think he's, you know, defensively, I think, you know, obviously I think offensively he's a solid player, but I think defensively is where he kind of comes in as well because, you know, he's a good matchup and he can play, you know, Wade. And I think you talk about Wade having the advantage in this series. I think that definitely would have negated him a lot more in terms of what he's been doing, in terms of his freedom. And the big thing for him, you know, Wade obviously is going to be, he's a great player, but, you know, when you kind of, you know you got the advantage, it's a lot different than kind of have to work for it and, you know, and work hard to get your points. You know, he's just kind of, you know, he's like Flash. You know, he's like the old days we saw him when they won 06. He's slashing, he's hitting inside shots, he's hitting outside shots, backdoor cuts, offensive rebounds and everything. It's just like, there's like, they don't have an answer for him right now to put him in check at all. And that gives them even more confidence to kind of, you know, expand his game out. So I think defensively is what's going to miss him the most, having a Butler, because a guy like that really kept neutralize, you know, you got to neutralize somebody in the series. And it's obviously Dwayne Wade's been the factor to matchups.
Yeah, and I think... Go ahead, Devon.
I was going to ask you, Mo, while we had you on the line, if you had any thoughts about the whole Ohio State Terrell Pryor situation. For those who aren't aware, Terrell Pryor announced today that he's not coming back to play his senior year at Ohio State, quarterback. He's going to either enter, well, I think he's going to enter the supplemental draft, which takes place here in a few weeks. For the NFL, but his lawyer also mentioned as a possibility he might play in the CFL. So, you know, we were just curious if you had any insight or any thoughts on the Terrell Pryor situation, Mo.
Yeah, we got into this big time on our show last Sunday, and, you know, Phil, I heard you doing some procrastinating before about what you had predicted, and they called this a while back that Trussell definitely was not going to make it to the season. And, of course, it's kind of played out how it has been. And, you know, I think it's been a sorry situation in terms of, you know, some of the things that have been done by the university. And I just remember looking back at some of the comments by the AD, like, if, you know, Jim Tressel's, you know, I'm worried if he's going to fire me and stuff like that. So it kind of really sounds like out of whack. And, I mean, I'm sure it happens in a lot of different schools. But, you know, yeah, I think, yeah, that, you know, the next question was after Tressel resigned was, you know, is Pryor going to play? And, you know, as the AD, how did he survive this situation as well? But, you know, I think a lot of things have happened. And, you know, you got to remember Jim Tressel, some of this stuff goes back a long ways. You know, you think about with Maurice Corrett and Troy Smith, who actually had some problems his junior year before he won the Heisman. And so there's a lot of,
yeah,
you know, little signals that have been going there for a long time there. And Tressel has a clean guy image, but, you know, just shows, you know, got that stuff over a long period of time, and so, you know, he got what he deserved, I think. And it, you know, obviously the situation is kind of going to rut itself out, and the fact that he resigned obviously makes you kind of think, okay, what else is out there? Because it's kind of like our congressman guy, you know, he comes out when everybody else is getting ready to come out with something else too. So you see it now, some story came out today, I don't know if you guys saw that, there was like, you know, like, I don't know, 400 minutes or some kind of minutes of conversations and texts and those kind of things that were going on with some of the Pryor's mentors and handlers back in Pryor's home area. So, you know, it's a sad situation. I'm not sure if it's, you know, indicative of all college, you know, big-time college sports, but it's like all these programs, you know, you see USC got their goal, BCS, the path get stripped from them. So, you know, it makes you really think about, you know, the state of college athletics and not just football, but basketball and other sports as well, in terms of, is this kind of just part of the game, or how do you, you know, this kind of indicative of what's really going on. But yeah, so the Trussell stuff we're looking at for a long time, and, you know, we predicted it, that it was going to go down badly once this, you know, smoke, there's fire. It's only a matter of time for people start talking and this gets out.
Go ahead.
One of the things I'm thinking of is, in my opinion, there needs to be some kind of reasonable statute of limitations.
you know, how was it in 2011 they can yank a championship that was won, you know, the better part of a decade ago? You know, I mean, at some point, I mean, let's put a 5-year statute of limitations on there. You know, I mean, after 5 years, skeletons in the closet just evaporate. You know, because, and I think it's a shame what's happened to those kids at USC and likely what's going to happen to, you know, future student-athletes at Ohio State, is where they're getting penalized after they have committed to play at an institution. And as the system is set up now, they will also get penalized in regards of losing eligibility if they decide to transfer. You know, and so I just think of this, and it's like, again, the student athletes, in my opinion, are getting the raw stick here. Like, they're getting the raw deal, especially student athletes. You know, most of the kids on USC's team, they never even met Reggie Bush, probably. But yet, they're paying for his sins. So, that's just something I think should really be reevaluated with the NCAA.
Yeah, I think it's you know, right now they got a system that what they're hoping to do, the more high profile it is, the more of a deterrent that they're trying to create for the future things happening. There's just so many leaks happening in the system. And like you said, I mean, there's no consistency in terms of how they implement punishments and things like that. And like you said, the impact on current players for things that happened a long time ago. I mean, it's just the whole idea of how an investigation happens and how the punishment comes down. There's got to be a process that speeds that along. It can't take 10 years to do this, but you handle the situation at Auburn in like 30 days. It just sends the wrong signals. And so those are things that drive people crazy. And then you try to justify both. It's like, wow. So I think there's some major problems here. You know, the fact that Pryor had 6 different cars, nobody knew about it, come on. You know, you and I have been around long enough. I mean, we all know that, you know, a kid driving a different car up every once in a while, we all going to be asking questions. You know, and so it's just that is the part that we struggle with around this. And the fact that he gets chased off for something that he was unable to do is ridiculous. Yeah, he has some responsibility as a young man, but when you have a system that's set up to keep allowing to go, I mean, hearing people say he was able to come late to things, I mean, that right there, was already unraveling. And nobody's coming to his defense because they saw the preferential treatment. So it's just it's unfortunate. You know, all I can say is, you know, team up north is happy.
Yeah. All right, fellas, I'm going to just break out of here, you guys, but I'm going to definitely be looking to follow up some conversations here on this issue. I know it's definitely some longer-lasting issues. And I also I'm going to give you guys a call back when the finals are over about some of the moves. We had a good conversation about, you know, some of the moves that were made, you know, the Bulls, obviously, in terms of their acquisitions. And, you know, there's a big debate in the offseason. A lot of folks were kind of doubting me or going against me when I was saying Bulls should have gave up our boy Noah to get Melo. So you see what's happening with Miami right now. You think the Bulls or some other team should have, you know, made some moves to get some other players. And I'll leave that for a future discussion for you guys, all right?
Well, hey, Mo, before you leave, tell people where they can get you.
Say again?
Tell people where they can reach you.
All right, you guys,
check
us out. Yeah, Sunday nights, 8 o'clock Central Time. You got the real sports – I mean, not the real sports guys. You got the Hallmark Skimmy and Mo show, still real sports guys talking sports. 3 guys, we're from all over the country here and giving it a little bit of a different flavor, but still, you know, the independent voice out there for us real regular guys talking sports and having a good time. So definitely check us out on Sundays at 8 p.m. Central.
All right, man. Well, it's good to have you on the show, man. And we'll have to jump on the show on Sunday.
All right, man. You got to get together, right. Do like a back-to-back show one of these days and do an extended night there.
All right, then. That sounds good. We'll work on that.
All right, then.
Take
talk
care,
to you guys later. Peace.
Yeah, the prior thing, man, is just it just takes turn after turn. So let me, they're talking about he might go to Canada, he might go to, what do you think happens to him? I mean, is the NFL ready? If he's not able to do the supplemental draft, what do you think? What's the next? Where is he? If you were an NFL team, how would you look at him?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, I think before we even answer that question, we need to look at how much this young man sacrificed, and people might be cringing thinking of Terrell Pryor and the word sacrifice in the same statement, but how much this young man sacrificed by agreeing to come back because he didn't get the benefit to have a pro day, to have professional trainers for a few months, to work on his mechanics, work on things that NFL coaches may want to see, similar to what they did with Cam Newton, where possibly he could have been a first-round pick or a second-round pick this past year. If you think about it, there were a lot of quarterbacks picked up in this first round that, are quote-unquote projects.
Yeah.
Cam Newton. The kid that went to Nashville, Jake Locker, and also the kid in Minnesota, he got picked up a little bit earlier than one would think in normal years. Mm-hmm. So if I'm Terrell Pryor, I've got to be thinking, what about me? But again, to your question, D, he's kind of got to deal with it at this point. And, the good thing about it is he can somewhat be on his own timetable right now. Where if he wants to have a pro day, he can do that. The supplemental draft, based on what's in the news, they're still planning on having that regardless of where the NFL labor situation is. And that is scheduled in July in sometime, I believe, in terms of the supplemental draft. So he also has the possibility to go to Canada to play. I don't like that move because we have not seen high-profile players in general make the move from Canada to the NFL on a consistent basis. Sure, we can pull out examples such as Doug Flutie, Warren Moon, but you just haven't seen that as a consistent route to the NFL. Now, again, Terrell Pryor isn't your everyday case, so perhaps that might be a good situation for him, but where he can showcase his athletic ability and his dual threat type of skills. But I believe if he wants to play in the NFL, he's going to need to show that he's more of a polished passer and has potential to developing into one, over his career.
Yeah, and I think even that new NFL league where you got some top coaches, that supplemental league, not really NFL league, but it's, that fall league or whatever that they're playing,
sure.
that might be a route for him. You can have a chance to be coached by Denny Green and some NFL top coaches who can provide a scouting report to the league, to NFL teams because these guys have coached the NFL teams. So that might be a route for him. And depending on what might be good for him is in the supplemental draft if he has the opportunity to go to a decent team. He has the opportunity to sit and learn, which is another piece. So, yeah, you're right. There's so many options. I said it back then when they were talking about the spin-off. I said they should have sit out. I said that a long time ago. I said it might be to their advantage to be like, I'm not playing in this bowl game. That would have been the stuff would have started toppling. If his parents or guardians would have said, look, because people knew that other folks knew, would have been like, hold up, how are you going to hem them up? I'm not going to pay in this bowl game. If he'd have, I'm just going to, put my name in for the draft.
when I said it, everybody probably thought I was crazy. But now it seems like it would have been a good strategy to just not play in the bowl game, you know, or to play in the, because if part of the commitment was I got to come back and miss five games, I said, he's not at an advantage. He's going to miss five games in his basically his senior year or whatever it might be. You know, he only has a few games. I mean, it might not be enough work for him to improve his draft status anyway. He may as well come out this year. So, you know, it's such a weird situation because when I suggested it, I was sure we had this kind of outcome. But now I look like it. That probably would have been a better strategy than the one he had right now. It's just, it's a mess. It's a legitimate mess. But that's how it goes, man. We'll have to continue to watch the saga. That is Ohio State right now and Pryor. And, you know, what I think is good about for Buckeye players is it at least allowed them to put it to bed because it's going to cut down the number of questions they're going to get next year. I mean, they still will get some. But, you know, as Buckeye players, it's probably not a bad thing.
On the banner and sign up for constant contact.
We got a little background noise. Ooh, you know, brought the news up in here.
As you say, technology.
Well,
technology.
Yep. The other thing that we had on here is Crabtree going at Alex Smith.
Who's the quarterback? So for those who aren't aware, Crabtree, the wide receiver for the 49ers in San Francisco, evidently Alex Smith, the much maligned quarterback for the 49ers, he's been holding workouts, player-only workouts, you know, much like a lot of other quarterbacks throughout the league. And evidently, Crabtree, you know, he's been doing his own thing. He's been working out on his own. So he was questioned. Michael, why haven't you been going to these workouts with the rest of your 49er teammates? And Crabtree pretty much said, first of all, who is our quarterback? You know, secondly, he said, you know, I've been working out on my own. I've been putting in my own work, and all my teammates know that. So to answer your question, I just started laughing, really. You know, I mean, it kind of speaks to just everything that's been going wrong in San Francisco over the last couple of years. You know, to have a guy come out and trash his teammate who's trying to organize and be a leader.
That's right.
You know, and just because he's not the starting quarterback, Crabtree's pretty much saying, you know, I mean, he don't have enough clout to have, you know, to draw me, pretty much. So, it was a little disappointing, you know, for Crabtree, who I see as a promising young receiver, although I believe this will be his third year and it's about time for him to kind of be a bit more consistent. I kind of expected more from him because, unfortunately, this kind of goes along with some of the negative press that he's gotten about it being about him, such as the way that he came into the league with missing all the training camp and, you know, the first part of the season over contract issues, you know. So I was a little disappointed in Crabtree, quite honestly.
Yeah, the next thing I expect to hear is this.
Great catch. That's right.
that's what we expect to hear next. Sometimes I go back to old what Bo Schembechler used to say, the team, the team, the team. Championship folks understand the value of the team. And you know, at some point, we let receivers just run wild. Like they really do a lot. Like, I'm not saying the receiver position doesn't matter, but the way that they have handcuffed defenses, more young, there's no other position on the field that somebody can come in right away and play in the way a receiver can. And that tells you all you need to know. And so for some of these cats, with the way that they've allowed defensive backs to be handcuffed, sometimes I feel like Roger Goodell needs to, if you want to control the league and control stuff, give these defensive backs a little bit more they can do. Let some of these cats get hit coming across. Sometimes Crabtree, people like that just need to get de-cleared. Sometimes, you know, some of these defensive players might just have to take a fine. Defensive players should just, at the beginning of the year, throw a lot of money in the hat and just say, this is just going to be the fine. We're just going to pay all our fines out of this. You know, everybody contribute to the fine. Because it's stuff like this that makes you want to take that shot. And
right.
It's unfortunate because, you know, I know Harbaugh and what he's like, and this is not something he's happy about. And if there's going to be any coach that's going to talk to somebody, I'm sure he's going to talk to him at some point. You know, they can't say nothing to the players right now, but I'm sure that Harbaugh will have a conversation with him when he has the opportunity. And he may have sent a pigeon. He may have sent a pigeon. Or somebody, a courier, or something to him to tell him to shut the hell up.
Man, it's really a precarious situation that these coaches are in. Yeah. You know, specifically new coaches that are trying to install, you know, entirely new programs where they have access problems. They can't legally access the players right now without violating, you know, the labor situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like you said, I'm sure Harbaugh is sitting there like, man, I wish I could talk to this dude. Or maybe he is talking to him, you know, decide it's worth the risk. Because these are issues that put a new coach and a new system in a traditionally successful franchise such as the 49ers, it's putting Harbaugh in a tough situation literally before day one.
That's right. That's right. But he hasn't been able to establish his program and the attitude, the way he wants things to be done. So now you already got unraveling, and he hasn't even been able to have an impact on them. You're right. So what do you think? Why, you know, you see they have the secret meetings that aren't so secret. What's your opinion on that? You know, some of the guys, they've been getting to understand that the fans are restless. What do you think is happening with some of these conversations?
See, I have no opinion. I really don't. my mom told me once, she only needed to tell me once, stay out of grown folk business. Okay? And so, quite honestly, I mean, there's been so much talk, speculation. Even the people that are paid to know, you know, Adam Schefter, he don't know. You know, so I think it's a good sign that they're meeting without all the posturing, without, okay, let's have everybody here, see everybody walk in, you know, have somebody who's at the table leak stuff, you know, to the press. I think it's kind of good that this kind of posturing is off the table, and hopefully they're making some true progress. That's my only opinion on it, D.
Okay. Well, I think they, and the fact that they're meeting, they're realizing that these fans are serious. You know, they got to realize that they got the golden goose and they got to figure it out. I've kind of stayed away from the NFL. I don't even watch NFL TV. I got it on my DirecTV. Just pass the channel. I had to stop. I'm not even trying to watch NFL TV. I'm not even stopping on the station. Not even watching reruns.
Quite extreme. That's very extreme, D.
That's just what I'm doing, man. I'm just not even checking the station out. I got serious with the NFL on there. I pass it quickly on Sirius. I don't stop there.
Wow.
So that's just me. Until they decide they want to get something done, I got a lot of other stuff I can do. The other thing is, my guy Plaxico is free. While we talk about the NFL. He walked out of the pictures of him walking out of jail. It looked like he just walking out of jail on the phone. But So who sides Plaxico? What happens with Plaxico? What's your opinion?
I don't know. It was encouraging to hear Plax say, whenever they're ready to play, I'll be ready as well. See, I think that's the only statement he's made so far. And so, you know, hopefully he can come out like Vic did and be very motivated, you know, in terms of getting your mind and body right. And he's, I believe he's a little bit older than Michael Vick when he first, you know, in terms of when they were both released. How old is Plaxico? In his mid-30s? 33, 34?
Yeah, he's got to be in his 30s.
Yeah.
He's got some years. So,
you know. Yeah, he's got size, man. He's, you know, he's always had some questions with his hands. You know, catching the ball was an issue with him, and that's not good when you're a receiver. But the one thing that he has that you can't teach, you can't coach, is size at the receiver position. And in the right offense, you know, kind of like how the Steelers used to utilize him, and especially in New York, he can be very, very effective. You know, he was very effective at stretches throughout his career. So I think in the right situation, and this is assuming that physically he's where he needs to be, because I highly doubt, especially in this day and age, I highly doubt that a player that's been through as much as he's been through won't at least wholeheartedly put their effort into putting themselves in the best possible position, mm-hmm. the best possible position to perform and be successful. Now, the question in my mind is, will his body respond? And I tend to think it will, you know, especially with all the different assets that athletes have available to them. Now, will it be this fall? Will it be next fall? I don't know. But I think at some point, physically, he'll be able to contribute. I just hope he gets an opportunity.
Hmm. Yeah, because he's sitting here. He was born in 77. So, I mean,
he's 33, 34. Same year I was born in. Yeah.
So, I mean, you're right. So, I mean, you know, 2 years of – but his size allows him to do things in the red zone and on the field, you know, that, you know, if he were a smaller stature, would be a problem. But because his size allows him the ability to do some things on the field. So, yeah, I think definitely, you know, it's the league. There are going to be some teams who are going to want him. There are not too many players away. You know, they talked about the Rams and some of the other things because of Spagnuolo. But, I mean, I think a number of people are going to be pursuers of it. And a lot of it depends on what kind of support they got around him. I mean, they did a really good job of, with Vic and everybody, of having the right people around him that could vouch for him until he could vouch for himself. And so he's going to continue to need that as well. I mean, I think they should look to the Vic formula to make sure there's people who can vouch on Plaxico's behalf that he's where he needs to be as a person, and his head's right and things like that. And then he got to put it together. He doesn't have as much time as Mike to get that next big deal, you know, which is, you know, going to be more problematic. But, you know, if you're not that far away, he's not a bad guy to have. You know, if you're a year or two away, or if you're just trying to get a jump start, you know, he's not a bad player to have, because that red zone, he gonna make it difficult on people in the red zone. You know,
he looked very good in the St. Louis Rams uniform. That's currently the reason of the country I'm in. I didn't grow up here, nor am I a huge Rams fan, but just due to proximity, that's the team I actually see play the most. And with a young quarterback such as Sam Bradford, you know, that, and a team that showed a lot of improvement, you know,
yeah,
between, you know, last season and then this past season, that's the biggest question that they had. That's the biggest position that they had questions at.
Yeah.
Was the receiver position. And They had a few guys that have had a tough time staying healthy. They actually brought in a veteran who came in just hoping to make the team that actually was their leading receiver this past year. I can't think of a guy off the top of my head, but they could really use the help at receiver out here in St. Louis.
Yeah, that's what I think, you know, there's going to be some needs. I mean, in the situation down in Miami, you know, they may be looking for someone like him to come in, you know, with Brandon Marshall and everything there. I think there's some places where he can fit. You know, if you got the right kind of coaching staff, some veteran guys, and keep things in place. If Crabtree keep acting a fool, he might end up out in San Francisco. You know.
Well, here's the thing. Plaxico has to understand that based on his situation and based on, you know, being in jail, coming out of jail, he can't be a diva anymore. He can't do the stuff that T.O. does or Ocho Cinco does or what Crabtree came out. You know, teams aren't going to be willing to deal with that right now.
That's right.
You know, especially with the quote-unquote baggage that he's bringing to the table. So that's why I say I'd be very surprised if he doesn't walk the company line, say and do the right things. You know, right now it's all about image. It's all about portraying himself in the way that he needs to be portrayed to have teams take risks. If I'm his agent, the first thing I do is, you know, I hire a PR person, you know, somebody that can really get to the point to really shape his image to where it needs to be, so that he won't be seen as a huge risk.
Yeah, and I think in addition to that, I think you got to get some mentors or advisors around him who come with some credibility around football. I mean, I think Tony Dungy did a great job for Michael Vick. It doesn't have to be Dungy, but it's got to be, you know, someone who brings that kind of credibility, you know, and also can have impact on Plaxico's life and have those conversations with him. So he's going to need that. He's going to need, you know, along with that marketing, he's going to need the right advising group around him. And, you know, Drew's going to have to figure out how to do that, you know. And, you know, Drew's already, you know, already saying to you, you know, Drew's moving into Drew mode. And Drew has got to be less thinking about teams wanting to have offers and being an agent. He's got to be more about, like you said, managing the image.
Right.
Drew is like, there's going to be several teams who are going to want to sign him. That's true, but that's not the message you want to be giving. You want to be talking about right now. You want to talk about he's just out. He's trying to settle with his family. You know, we're looking forward to talking to people about him, but he's just trying to, you know, he's trying to get reconnected with his family right now. You know, you got to send a different kind of message. You can't move into agent mode. So, you know, seeing how Drew might manage that, he's going to have to really think through that. A little bit, and I mean, obviously you've been doing it longer than I have. I haven't been doing it, but you're right. The image thing and having the right advisors around him is going to be key.
Yeah.
You know, the people he respects and people he'll listen to, which will be good. Well, that's probably more NFL than I care to hit on with. But let's go back. We're gonna get to our segment that we have done in the back. It's called
Five on the Black Hand Side.
So Five on the Black Hand Side. You know, one of the things that we've been hearing about is kind of this Jordan versus LeBron. And so Five on the Black Hand Side, we have an issue and we have five kind of questions or statements that we want to kind of address related to the issue. And so in the best interest as we close the show to kind of get us back in the NBA mode, the first, I'll hit you with the first one.
is Michael not the best scorer ever? There's a lot of questions about that versus LeBron. So that's kind of how Michael was portrayed, is that he's the best scorer ever versus the greatest ever. How do you feel about that?
Michael was a great scorer. Okay, he was on a scale of 1 to 10, he was a 20. But to say that he was the greatest scorer ever, I'm not so certain. I feel that Michael Jordan was probably the best player that I ever saw during my lifetime, but I use the word player, not scorer. A lot of people say Michael was more of a scorer versus a shooter, and I agree with that. But in terms of saying that he was the best scorer ever, that's hard for me to say that because I think of one-dimensional guys that didn't play the defense that Michael played, weren't the leaders that Michael was. They didn't have that dog meter that you talk about that Michael had. I think about Gervin. Gervin was a very talented technical scorer, okay? You think about guys like Dominique. You know, I mean, there's a lot of guys who were scorers that possibly may have been a little bit more efficient, and even statistically more proficient than Jordan was in terms of scoring. You know, Karl Malone was a great scorer. Maybe not as good as Michael, but again, when you bring in Michael, you're bringing a lot of other things in addition to him being a great scorer. He was a great a lot of other things, such as defensive player and other things I've already mentioned. So I would tend to lean on the side that he is not the best scorer to ever play.
Yeah, and I think also just by the whole score, I think Michael was, in his time, one of the best defenders, if not the best defender. He's a lockdown guy. I mean, one-on-one, away from the ball, lockdown, just defender, which, you know, one of the things I think about what makes Michael, you got some categories. So if you're talking about scorer, you're probably going to have him in the top five, if not the best. You know what I'm saying? If you're talking about defensive player for his position, you know, however you want to position him in small forward or two guard, he's probably going to be a top five defender, if not the best defender. You know, and you start rebounding guard, might put him in the top five of rebounding guards. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So you start to add those categories, he's going to be, more often he's going to be in the top five of those categories than most other players. He's probably going to be the most person listed in the top five category in those ways. And so I think that's where, is he the best scorer ever? He was deadly. I think clutch score, I think, you know, what a phase of the moment. But I think that, like you said, that had a lot of stuff to do with the kind of competitor he was. He wasn't afraid of the moment. He had the killer instinct, that kind of stuff. I think he had over a lot of players. Number two, kind of give me three areas of LeBron's game where he's the top three.
Ooh, that's a tough one. Well, that's a tough one. I'm going to have a hard time coming up with three. I think one is that he has a level of vision in terms of finding open players that I haven't seen a ton of over the last 30 years that I've been watching basketball. You know, I think of Magic Johnson, you know, where he just has a feel for the game, where he can put the ball, like he can put the ball in the right position for scorers. You know, you think about what he did with that Cleveland team.
Yep.
I mean, he made, you know, Ilgauskas, you know, that little 15-foot pick and pop. I mean, he made Big Z get some all-star votes. And, I mean, that in itself is a coup. You know, he made a lot of guys look a lot better than what they were. So
So the one thing I could come up with is vision. In terms of, I think if you look at small forwards, he's certainly in the top three for his position in terms of vision and court awareness. And you may even put a push to put him in the top five, top ten. I don't know about top three in terms of players that have ever played the game in terms of court vision and court awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Two additional areas, I might have a hard time with that one, D.
Well, and I think, and my boy the Game Changer put this one together, and if I were thinking about just in the league currently, if I took the question like that, I'm thinking about, so I'm not thinking about where we might go with that. I'll just say in the league currently, I think one of the things you think about is court vision and court awareness. I think that's it. His ability to facilitate is as good as anyone in the league. Which is that court vision. I think in the playoffs, he's begin to show himself as a top defender in a way that we hadn't thought about him before, because we hadn't had a chance to really see him evolve in that part of his game. And I think that's probably been one of the best things about him being with the Heat, is that we've been able to see we've been able to see the full part of his arsenal in terms of his game. We've been able to see the defensive part of it. I think he's, definitely in terms of perimeter defender, you want to put him quickly. Anytime you can hold Derrick Rose the way he held Derrick Rose, you're a elite defender. And I think it'll start reflecting in all defensive teams, first team, maybe MVP. I mean, he's going to get some recognition for that. Finisher. When you talk about finishing, nobody finishes better than LeBron. notwithstanding that point blank layup he missed in game two, but if he gets near the rim, it's like he just closes the deal in a way that a lot of players don't close the deal. Just with power, people get out the way when he's coming through the lane. But he's a great finisher.
Yeah, as far as finisher, I think of that series he had against Detroit. I don't want to guess what year it is. I would guess it was probably in 2007, maybe. Where he went off and scored 30 something points in the fourth quarter. Cleveland got in that 1-4 set, man, every time he got to the rack, I mean, he just finished. Or he got to the line, and there was just nothing that they could do with him. He was splitting double teams. He was doing so much. I think one of the many fortunate things of him going to the Heat this year is that he's had more opportunities to be a wing guy on the break, a trailer on the break, somebody who benefits from, strong deliveries from Wade, where in the past, we didn't see LeBron very much on the receiving end, where he could finish on the break. We saw him finishing in the half court, And so to me that's been exciting because, you're right. I've seen him finish a lot more in different ways in Miami than he did in Cleveland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, even seen him come off the ball and come off screens off the ball and things that you just didn't see. The finishing thing is a big one. This is a great question because Game Changer actually texted me this, which I thought was great. Which guy would be better if they switch bodies? I thought that this is the best question I've ever heard because he texted me this one about, if LeBron was Michael's size, would he still be able to be LeBron? And what about Michael being LeBron's size, but if they switch bodies? Who would be the center player?
that's a classic Game Changer, Marcus Fowler's type of question. High quality, high substance, just a very well-rounded effort. that's one that gets you excited thinking about it. You can really sink your teeth into this one. because it's dangerous to think about Michael Jordan in LeBron's body. I mean, it's almost illegal. It's almost like taboo to think about that possibility. And for me, is when, like, there was a point in Jordan's career, maybe when he came back from playing baseball, where he did not have the athletic ability that he had before he left.
Mm-hmm.
It was still great. It just wasn't elite anymore. And maybe elite's a bad word. Instead of being out of this world, it was an atmosphere. And what Jordan did is he started working on his post game. He started working on his turnaround. He started polishing and becoming even a better mid-range shooter. Think about if he had LeBron's body when he was developing that post game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a scary one, man. I'm about to sleep on that one. That's a tough one there.
Yeah, I would say Michael would be better. Because if you think about Michael and LeBron's body with that dog meter, I mean, there might be blood. It'd be like trying to tackle Bo Jackson.
Yeah.
It'd just be, you get out of the way. If I were looking at that one, I would say Michael, but it's one that could be debated on a regular basis. The next question is six rings. As Game Changer said, is that really the only argument we need?
Yes.
Six rings, six MVPs, right?
Well, that's a real quick question. Yes.
But we have to wait. You know, this is a game changer. But LeBron has better stats and is a better all-around player. So statistically, LeBron has you look at all of his stats, they're better. So how do you, I heard some guys debating this on the air, like, how do you debate greatness? You know, is it individual stats? Because that's the whole thing when they were talking about Shaquille and ranking the top five, and, you know, where is greatness comes, you know, where is that? Because especially with, like, Bill Russell and his stats, you know, 44% from the field, but he had 11 rings,
right.
You know, versus Wilt didn't have a lot of rings, but how can you argue with averaging 50 and then the next year averaging 45, and then people talk about scoring and leading the league in assists? You know, how do you argue that? So, you know, where do stats fit in for you, and how do you evaluate greatness or in that sense?
Well, I think winning is the great neutralizer. You know, we talked about this a few weeks ago. That's the reason why Scottie Pippen is probably seen as a better player and a better overall, like having a better overall career than Charles Barkley. You know, because Pippen has six rings. You know, I mean, you think about Bill Russell. You know, personally, I think Derek Jeter is probably a modern day Bill Russell in terms of, you know, he has very strong statistics, you know, very strong numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you think about the captain, you think about a lot more than stats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about winning. You know, I believe he has four or five rings, something to that effect. You know, in terms of today, I mean, that's in the neighborhood of what Russell had, you know, in terms of dominance and today's free agency era. So, you know, I think that's a tough one. When you try to compare LeBron's numbers to, say, Jordan, you're right. You'd probably be a bit more fair to LeBron if you compared his numbers to Magic, quite honestly. You know, if you looked at the next 5 to 6 years where LeBron, D-Wade, and Bosh are still going to be in their prime, you know, assuming that there's no injuries, you know, I can forecast that LeBron's numbers may look a lot more like Magic's than than Jordan's. And unfortunately, I think he may be criticized for that. You know, we've seen that over the past couple of games. The kid gets 17-9, they win, and he's having to answer hostile questions from the media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Magic could put up these same numbers, you know, and, you know, a game here and there, you know, Magic will blow up for 30, 40 every so often, you know, later on in his career, towards the middle of his career. Now, earlier in his career, he was more of a scorer. But, you know, towards the middle and end of his career, he scored when he needed to,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so, I mean, that's my take on that.
Yeah. And just as you were saying about LeBron making a play, he just had his dime to Wade drilling down the court. That just as you were making your point, LeBron was making that point.
That's right.
It's that we need media with a higher basketball IQ, but. Yeah, I think that whole how you know, winning plays an important role in, you know, somehow winning has to be part of the equation to get you in the room, right? You have to be – so the question is how many championships get you in the room? You know, and I always say that you at least got to have three to get in the room, unless you will.
Yeah, I mean, I say you at least got to have one, man. You have one. You can enter the conversation. Just one. Now, the more you have, you know, the stronger your argument will be.
Yeah.
But if you have at least one.
Yeah.
And it's almost like NFL winning coaches.
Yeah.
You know, Super Bowl winning coaches. You just have one, you're in the conversation.
Yeah.
You know, you're a quarterback, you won the Super Bowl. You just have one. And again, unless your name's Trent Dilfer, you're in the conversation. You know, you're in a conversation before Marino, unfortunately.
Yep. And that's what it is. You got to know what. Yeah. So at least one championship gets you in the room, and then you can start having a debate and about you know whether that who's the greatest ever in that. But this whole LeBron, you know, seven. You know, it was good to have this on five on the Black Inside. We had to bring the game changer into it. Like you said, the brother's always asking some deep questions to force you to think a little bit. Yeah, I was trying to think about my answers. I was like, he would have me on the spot to look at. We look forward to having him back in the thing. The other thing that I probably wanted to look at, if you're thinking about. You think about these two teams, and we'll probably get deeper into this as we get, it's going to be another barn burner. Like I said, all that talk is down the stretch. It's a one-point game.
That's right.
But, you know, another shot. This is like a heavyweight fight. This is like, you know, like one of them thrillers. Those every night is a battle. But as you look at these teams, thinking about the next step for these two teams, what do you think they need to do in the offseason, win or lose?
Well, Miami, and this might be tough, man, because, you know, with their cap situation and the uncertainty of, you know, the NBA and their pending lockout, they need more consistent shooters. And that's the same thing I would say when they put these teams together. I think if Mario Chalmers, if he continues to progress, he can certainly be helpful in that situation. I think they need a little bit more depth on their bench. If Haslam's healthy the whole year,
mm-hmm.
that also helps them quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But a Tyson Chandler, who I believe is going to be a free agent this year, don't quote me on that,
mm.
he would look very good in the Miami Heat uniform.
Mm.
Somebody who can do just what he's doing for Dallas. If they had somebody like that in Miami, oh, my goodness. I mean, that would just really free them up and give them the flexibility on defense. What I think Miami can't do is just get anybody to fill in there. because they're a totally different team. They don't have to have Dan Pierre out there or Big Z out there or McGore out there. When they can stay young and active, we can just see how dangerous they can be on defense. How are the Mavericks for you, man?
Well, I think the Mavs, first of all, get, you know, I don't know what they're going to do with Butler, but if they can keep him, I think he's either restricted or unrestricted free agent. But if they can keep him, that'll be good. I think they need to add in, they need another guard with size who can get into the paint. You know, they need to keep Chandler. But, they need somebody on the wing or in the backcourt who can get their own shot, because that's going to make Terry and some of these guys even better. But they need somebody who can create their own shot, either, you know, backing up Jason or, you know, starting in that backcourt or something. They need to find a way to become more explosive offensively off the dribble. And then I think the other thing I would look at is they can do this too is a low post score, because that makes Dirk even more powerful. If you can add another, you know, kind of low post score guy who can get down on the block and create something down there, that would be nice. But they need somebody who can really make scoring easier for them, so they don't always have to work so hard against great teams. When you get in a series like this, who can get some buckets down there, you know, for them. But I think having somebody at least can go off the dribble on their own. And create some stuff, who just doesn't care, would be good for them. And I don't know how they're going to do that, but they do need that. And that's got to come from something. He's got to come from a wing position. You know, I think a healthy Butler is going to help with that, but I think they need one more person outside of Butler that would help with that.
Yeah.
So I think they have the ability to do that at some point. But I agree with your Miami assessment. I think, you know, getting a guy like Tyson Chandler, you know, I think Chalmers being a little bit older and you know, especially if they win the ring this year, he can kind of grow into that spot. You know, I think they got to be – I think if they win, they're going to get more people taking the minimum to come and play with them. I think that's what winning can do for them. You know, it'll get up to people who want to come and play with them and get a ring. And, you know, they're going to have a, you know, with a guy like Riley recruiting, you know, they're going to have an opportunity to get some good people. So, you know, this is big. I think, you know, even if they lost in the 7-game series, I think they'll still get some people to come and play with them because they know they're close.
Yeah.
But I think if they get a Chandler, that would just – their defense would be suffocating.
Yeah. You know, that may be too ambitious. That may, you know,
yeah.
I know it was my point, but, you know, because Tyson Chandler is relatively younger. Well, I guess you can't say that anymore. He's a younger player. He's a veteran. He came in as an 18-year-old. But, you know, I mean, this contract is probably a contract that he's going to be looking to get paid and get some length in that deal. And I don't know if, well, I mean, I'm pretty certain the Miami Heat can't do that.
Well, we're getting down here at the stretch. We got about, you know, we're moving on 90 seconds, moving on a minute here. I'll let you, you know, as the band hold it down, you know, you did your, you were Vinny tonight. I'll let you have the final words to say to the people to send us home.
Well, I tell you what, man, good times. Had a great time tonight. Looking forward to the Game Changer comeback. I want to say after this series is over, and hopefully the Heat win, I really would like to have some conversations to see where the Heat weigh in terms of overall historically good teams. I'd love to see Ray come in or us break it down like he did, just taking the first five and just going, I take this guy over that guy, you know, breaking it down. Because the thing is, the Heat win, and the way that they played this playoff, you know, it might be a worthwhile conversation.
Yeah, that might be it. You know, just looking at it, I don't care how you look at it, depending on which teams you put him up against, it's basically weighted in LeBron, and I think everybody else is going to be at the end of the list. But we'll have to debate that after the season. But we'll keep it going. Until next time, Real Sports Guys, y'all.